Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Well, everybody might know him from his four previous appearances on RFRX. But David is an educator and trainer for health providers and other professionals. He also has a private practice helping adults and couples with learning resiliency skills related to relationship difficulties and trauma. He hosts a podcast, Humanities of Values, and a blog related to mental health topics. David Teachout has worked in mental health care for 15 years and holds a master's in both forensic and counseling psychology. And he's currently working towards a doctor of psychology in clinical psychology. Maybe he can explain what that means to us. He's also worked in community mental health, social work, criminal justice, elder care, and child advocacy. What has he not worked in? Welcome back, David.
Thank you, Rob. I'm not sure I haven't worked at anything that I haven't. It's weird. It's basically every single demographic that out there is. I've worked with. It's been actually incredible. I love people. So,
and how are you feeling about doing your fifth presentation for RFR?
I mean, I haven't received the T-shirt from Eric yet, so I'm a little bummed. There needs to be like an RFR with a fist like raised in the sky kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. RFR high five.
All right, we can go there.
Yeah. You know, I think that what happens is I am, the RFR buys me a plane ticket, I fly out and I give you a big old bear hug and say thank you from the bottom of my heart, and then that's number five. I mean, wait till you get to 10, that's gonna be something else real special.
Probably not legal in most states, but you know, it's okay. We'll be fine. I'm in South Dakota now, so everything's legal here. We're good. Yeah.
So does David have? Is this the most anyone's done?
I don't have that off the top of my head right now, but
I can't remember anybody even doing four. So I'm betting yes.
Well, so David, what are we talking about today? What's the deal with this?
So yeah, thank you everybody for filling out the polls. I figure the first one is my attempt at a Fox News poll. That the answers are weighted. What's funny though is that, as sometimes happens even on Fox News, it didn't go quite the way I expected, because the no's still outweighed the yeses, even though there were two options to go there. So
let's go ahead and share the poll results and go through them. Does that sound good?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So the first question, holidays are the worst. Most of the people, like David said no. 56% said no, they're not the worst. Yeah. If I had answered this even 2-3 years ago, I would have definitely said yes, it's absolutely the worst. And only 16% said obviously yes, and another 28% said yes. So and then question number two is a feeling of disconnection during the holidays. 46%, which is the highest, said some of the time, and only 4% said not at all. Any thoughts on that, David?
I think that one is less surprising, people are feeling, in fact, you know, I feel disconnected, mm-hmm. which essentially is looking at, the vast majority are either all the time or some of the time feeling disconnected, and which is good for today's talk, because that is very much what we are going to be focusing on, is why that's the case and how some concrete things to do about it. Thank you for your answers. While at the same time, I feel for you that is what the answer is. So
I have to wonder if, like, well, how does that compare to just general, how you feel about this, that generally, and not just during a holiday time?
Yeah, it's often going to depend on the demographics. I mean, it's really, if I recall correctly, you know, there's a bigger disconnect in urban areas than rural, which you'd think would be the opposite because population density would be, you know, greater in the urban, but no, which I mean, really, when you think about it, it's not too surprising, given the fact that most people out in the so-called countryside have already have other traditions and they have different socioeconomic issues that are going on there. So cities have really not been the greatest invention of modernity, but that's a whole other presentation. Yeah.
And then question number three, I actively seek to find my own meaning in holidays. Neutral sometimes and not at all. We're about the same, around 13%. The biggest one was some of the time I seek to find my own meaning. That was 36%. And 22% said all of the time I seek to find my own meaning. And we're going to talk more about the whole meaning part of the holidays, which I'm excited about. All right. So, and then favorite holiday, Christmas, just slightly edged over them, but I'm surprised Halloween didn't get way more than 12%. Come on, that's like the best ever.
My birthday was outvoted Halloween. Like, that's which it's awesome. I love the fact that that many people believe that their birthday deserves to be its own holiday. Like that.
Absolutely.
That's a healthy ego right there.
Yeah.
You that's awesome.
For me, it's a close between Halloween and my birthday.
I have a friend who has spent, it has to be upwards of $25,000 to do his whole area in Halloween. He's the kind of people, you know, thousands of people flow through it at Halloween time. It is freaking amazing. And he crashes like the week after Halloween. It's just like,
oh, I bet.
Forget Christmas, you know, it's like, oh.
So let's get into this, David. You know, yeah. Holidays traditionally for me have been, especially Thanksgiving and Easter and Christmas, coming from a religious family, those have been really stressful. And I've found ways that I've coped with it just by getting a book and going into the corner. Because the gatherings that you and I, we were talking about this earlier, the gatherings that my family would have would be like well over 60, 70 people. And it was not something I wanted to be a part of at all. And so I dread holidays coming up.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, you don't even have to be non-religious to dread it. You know, there's a lot of what I'm going to refer to as social weight attached to holidays. You know, there's personal history. There's the history of the holidays themselves, which have over the last several years definitely been getting a lot of various and different attentions, sociocultural practices that can be controlling, or certainly felt to be as such, can be almost really oppressive, you know, from a, you know, social perspective. Like we were just talking before, you know, this about the sheer number of people who engage in, for instance, decorations without even really knowing that it has absolutely nothing to do with their religious, you know, holiday in that sense. You know, the idea of a tree, you know, I believe Eric, you pointed out, where, I mean, it's no joke in, somebody can, you know, look up the verse, but you know, it's like, you are not to have a tree. Like, it is a legitimate pagan thing to do. And yet it is standard shtick to have a Christmas tree. So, you know, and this isn't to go into a whole lot of, oh my gosh, hypocrites, because I mean, the reality is that, you know, many religious ideas are quite fungible and that's why they last for a long time. But it is fascinating to have people engage in so many different behaviors, use similar terminology. And as a result, people who are hearing one story attached to it, a story of oppression and a story of emotional manipulation and hurt and possibly, in fact, even likely rejection for various ridiculous reasons, is you know, every time somebody mentions certain terms and certain ways of acting, those come along for the ride. So it's, for most people, Christmas lights, Christmas trees are not just the things themselves. They are all the meaning and the history and everything else that comes along, because our brains don't ever get rid of things. So, you know, the emotional, you know, baggage just comes along. And unfortunately, you know, that's part of just being human. And is a little bit, it's definitely what we're going to be talking about, as you know, one, having a better understanding of why that is, and then two, some concrete things to do to help mitigate the effects. So, yeah.
Cool. So set this up for us. What's what's the first step here?
So I want to, you know, back up a little bit, because I've been meaning, you know, talking about, you know, meaning itself, you know, what is the purpose? Why do we care so much about words and make-believe, you know, dates? Like, I mean, literally the entire experiences of all of this, every last piece is just the flim-flam of conscious, imaginative, constructions. You know, it's not like we go and find, you know, Thanksgiving floating in the air and go, oh, wow, yes, we really need to have this in our life. I mean, it's literally a social construction. It could have been any other day. We could have added any number of things to it. We haven't. You know, Christmas, for that matter, you know, is obviously, as anybody who's studied history whatsoever, Jesus, if in fact he even existed in some capacity, did not get born in December 25th. I mean, this is a, you know, made up thing for a lot of historical reasons. And yet, even knowing that, so many people, particularly who leave, you know, the various faith traditions, they know some of the history. They've looked into it, may have even informed why they left. And yet, every time these holidays roll around, we find ourselves inundated with this internalized weight of all the accumulated meaning that has, you know, been thrust upon us, that we learned. And so why? is this such a big deal?
Well, I've heard that before, that Jesus definitely wasn't born on December 25th. Why is that not real? What's...
I mean, you know.
I mean, there's 365 other days, 0.25 other days that he could have been born on. But why would December 25th?
Or none of them.
Well,
I mean, yeah, I'm not in the camp of Jesus didn't exist at all. But there is a history behind why December 25th was chosen. And it completely escapes me right now. But there were a lot of, you know, sociopolitical reasons for it. And there are a lot of, you know, historical analyses of why that occurred. And well, we're studying, because it's fascinating. Like, why do we pick certain things for ascribing meaning to it? You know, this goes into, you know, anybody really ponder memes or, you know, various, you know, products that have been, you know, shipped to us over the years. I mean, literally Pet Rocks, probably my favorite example from the late 80s.
I had a Pet Rock.
Yes.
It was named Gregory, just for the record.
Yeah.
You named your Pet Rock?
You did?
That's awesome.
How did you not name your Pet Rock?
I had a Pet Rat. I didn't have a Pet Rock.
Yeah. I mean... It's it's a rock. Literally, people paid money for a rock that you could go and get in your backyard. I mean, it's just stunning. I mean, the initial digital games, the Tamagotchis or whatever those stupid things were. I mean, people were having emotional breakdowns when their pixelated creature died, you know, on these things. And you're like, oh my gosh, what, like... Why are we doing this? to ourselves in particular. And so,
no, that's interesting that you say that, because like growing up as a kid, I had a ton of stuffed animals, and I felt like they were their own. I wanted them to be real, and I gave them each names, and I kind of played with them, and a few of them I came up with back. In fact, and we see this on all over the social media. I had a hernia operation when I was like 5 or 6. And I took Fluffy in with me, and he had a hole in his side, and the surgeon stitched both me and Fluffy up, and we came out with the bandages at the same time. And
very nice. You did name your stuffed animals. That's good. I'm glad to hear that.
I did. Fluffy. But it sounds like it's a similar phenomenon to the Tamaguchi and the pet rocks and mm-hmm. Things like that.
Well, and literally pretty much anything we do. I mean, everything that we wear, people wearing crosses for Christianity to, beads and so on. And none of this is to, say, oh my gosh, we need to get rid of all of these, items or whatnot. I mean, maybe crosses. I've never understood the idea of wearing a torture symbol as a symbol of love. But, it's really, it's inevitable that we're going to do this. And one of the reasons for this, and I've talked about it a little bit before in a different presentation, is about this notion of prediction modeling. Habits, cultural habits, the meaning that we give to various behaviors and the items that that get the meaning attached to them, are about cultural practices. And one of the things I recently had. Pointed out when it comes to culture is that often we think of culture as this collection of various behaviors and actions and so on and so forth. And really, though, culture is a way of helping one another predict better what the people in your groups are going to do. Like, it is a mechanism that helps reduce essentially cognitive load that allows us to go, by and large, if I enter into this situation, I know from previous cultural experience to expect this colors and this behavior and these words and so on. So it allows us to do a couple of things with that. One, it allows us to maintain a degree of consistency in knowing that what is going to happen next, so that we can, measure out our resources and have that, sense of solidarity and consistency with going, oh, my vision of the world is pretty accurate. Every time I step into, a bar, I know what I'm going to get. I'm going to get certain smells. I'm going to get certain behaviors. I'm going to get certain expectations around that behavior and what people do and these things and so on. Or walk into a certain church and so on. Like, all of these things are allowing us to kind of offload the concerns we have about change and buttress that anxiety with a lot of prescribed behaviors that allow us to go, oh, we're in this together, kind of thing. And so they provide a way of going, okay, so the meaning we give to these practices then guides our conscious deliberation. It guides our ability to say, oh, okay, rather than getting, bogged down with trying to figure everything out at every freaking moment of every day, instead, it's almost like it's a social cultural download. We just, thank you for giving me this. I don't have to think any, much further about it. I'm just going to keep on doing it, which is why so many social cultural practices are done. But if you were to look at the history of some of them, you approach people about it, they're like, what are you freaking talking about? This is, of course, a Christmas tree is Christian. It's in the word Christmas. I mean, it's like, rings for weddings, not a Christian thing, or, it's
bunnies and eggs and Easter?
Yeah, bunnies and eggs. I mean, that's
all. I never got that. As a Catholic, I never got that at all.
Well, I mean, what's the three basic things of that of which meaning is all about? It's the fighting, fleeing, and the other F word. You know, I mean, it's, you know, everything.
Fornicating.
Yeah, see, there you go, fornicating. So, you know, we have all these things in order to give us structure so it makes life a little more bearable so that we can reduce our anxiety and know that, wait a minute, if I, you know, I know at least in this area of my life what's going to happen next. I may not like it. I may not, you know, appreciate what's going, what I see coming next, i.e. the holidays, for instance, but at least I have an idea of what to expect about it. And so with this, you know, comes then this idea of group cohesion in the face of adversity. This is why we create these practices. And it could be the adversity from, you know, another group. It could be an adversity from contrarian ideas. You know, we have a bunch of, you know, behaviors that we do depending on the group in order so that we never have to face ideas that are contrary to our own. But it can also be the adversity of just existential dread, the idea of death itself, the fact that at some point we are all going to.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days, and now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.
You know, slough off this mortal coil and move on, and we really have no freaking clue what is after. And so this allows us to have some kind of means of dealing with and not facing it. So if anything, you know, holidays and the creation of all these things is one ginormous avoidance strategy to deal with the fact that really what we're doing is just making up shit as we go along. And if we can just say, but no, this has intrinsic meaning, this has, you know, deeper stuff, then we ignore the fact that really it's just all made up. Like, we, you know, there were various peoples and things happened to catch on. Just like, you know, the TV show, was it Masquerade or The Family or something? It was a late 80s vampire show that lasted for all of 10 episodes. It was great, but it was before vampires became a thing in the grander, you know, Hollywood thing. And so it tanked. I mean, it was just, they had some great actors at the time, some pretty decent writing for its time, and boom, it was about, I think it came out like 5 or 6 years before the sparkly vampires. And, you know, we can all really have a lot of problem with those movies, but they certainly helped usher in a new golden age of exploring age. All these things. Sparkles. Yeah, it's all about the sparkles. But yeah, I mean, so much of this, you know, when we really stop and look at why things catch on, why things, have the meaning they do, when we just pause for a moment, we realize we're just making it up. And sometimes that can be empowering. In fact, I would say that it is. At the same time, it can also be quite, for lack of a better word, soul destroying when you realize that this doesn't really have more meaning than what collectively, whatever that may mean, the size of it may mean that it has. So
you make a really good point, because looking back, whenever I would show up to a holiday event, there always be the same thing. We'd always do the same thing. Presents around a tree, praying mm-hmm. over the meal, maybe going to church or something like that. But I just continued to do it because mm-hmm. that's all I knew. That's what I was taught. I never considered that was kind of just all made up. And mm-hmm. I didn't have to do that if I didn't want to.
Yep. And what's powerful about those things, because this is not about getting rid of meaning. One, good luck, not going to happen. What it is taking a step back and being able to look at these practices in all of their various ways and looking at what they're trying to address. They're trying to address a intrinsic, bone-deep human need to, you know, find some kind of purpose and give structure to life. And, you know, so, I mean, you mentioned family stuff. I love hearing about, family traditions, because some of them are just like, how does this make any sense? Or they happen to be very similar to others, surprisingly, or not at all similar. And yet, if you, you know, look back at them and go, okay, what was the purpose? And so much of it was about those predictive behaviors, knowing that, you know, here's the anxiety about whether or not you got the present you wanted and how all this was going to be, you know, done emotionally. But you knew that you had a structure to the day ahead of you where you did this and then that, and here you are. And everybody just collectively gathered around and did it together, and it was okay. I mean, we had a thing about, you know, our family, we had stockings first, then breakfast, then major presents. And of course, being the pain in the ass that I was and still am, you know, as I got older, I got into the habit of eating slower and slower the breakfast, because until everybody was done, we couldn't go over and open up the major presents. And so it was just one of those things where it's like, I'm just gonna eat my pancakes one little bite at a time.
I never understood my friends who had their family traditions was to open presents on Christmas Eve.
Yeah,
that was like almost a war like between us. How could you do that?
Well, and there you have it. Like you will, like you'll get into some, you know, some people start sharing some of these very individualistic family traditions and people get downright pissed. Like, how dare you open presents?
You're not a true Christian.
Like, are you freaking out of your mind? This is made up. Like, and it doesn't reduce the meaning of it. It just goes, it's also made up. Like, this is what we're just doing together. And so, and part of that as well is also then to, one is, you know, one comment mentioned, you just never question it. And two, they often will occur for so long that we don't bother to look back and go, why did we start this in the first place? Mm-hmm. Like some families, you know, when you really start digging in, they're like, wait a minute, why did we start? Like, we didn't, when we first started, we didn't open a present for the New Year's Eve. And then you start finding out that one year it was because I've heard from one family, you know, the father, his younger family, father got deployed on Christmas Day. And they found out like 3 days before. And so it was like, hey, we're going to do this. And then from then on, it became a way of celebrating the fact that they cared. They wanted to send off, you know, this experience and going, hey, we are willing to even break from tradition and make our own to, you know, provide meaning for our own family. And But that only got remembered when they actually started talking about it together. You know, they were just like, well, no, this is what we've always done. And then somebody's like, wait a minute, no, it isn't. I'm like, wait, why did that happen? And then all of a sudden it all comes out, which then adds to the weight of the meaning itself, actually. It's like, oh, well, shoot, let's really remember this. This is why it was so important to us, because we were celebrating, oh my God, you know, my father was leaving, you know, in this time and going off, and we didn't know if he was going to survive. And I mean, it's just so many of these things that instead of removing them, we learn to really just start asking more questions about why they've come up. What is the meaning behind it? What was the purpose? And then asking, maybe we can change it. Maybe we can tweak it a little bit to make it our own. Maybe we can remember that really this is a universal attempt at dealing with, you know, issues that we all are, of not only existential dread, but community, you know, togetherness and the need to belong. And it all manifests in various ways, some of which 100% disagree with, but, you know, they're, you know, still addressing, you know, very basic needs.
So what's your experience with family, you know, two people who get married, who come from families with very different traditions that are contrary to one another in that regard? How do they work that out?
Often poorly.
yeah. Like we open presents on Christmas Day. We open presents Christmas Eve. Now you have, you know, the husband feels one way and the wife feels the other, and they have a kid. And
that's where communication and, you know, it's a lot of, it's really those two things. One, recognizing that this is made up, and two, that simply because it is made up doesn't remove our capacity for feeling, you know, bigly about it. You know, it really is, you know, because it's made up, in fact, it allows us the freedom to be able to find and highlight that this process of making shit up and, you know, in our meaning and purpose is what it means in many ways to be human. And so every time we're engaged in the meaning-making process, we are engaged in exhibiting what it is to be human, what it is to, you know, be caught up in this strange world in existence that none of us actually asked. And maybe some of us had we been asked would have said, hell no, I'm waiting for the next time around. You know, I mean, it's just, we didn't ask and here we are. And so what are we going to do about it? And, you know, it's something that, at least for myself, one way of looking at it is that it's a profoundly ethical practice to engage in, to look at this meaning-making process, because from Mark Johnson, Morality for Humans. Highly recommend this book. I have probably highlighted it before. So because it really is one of my go-to places for a comprehensive ethical system. But, you know, he notes that when we look at moral deliberation, you know, we're reconstructing our experience in a way that resolves the morally problematic situation that's confronting us. So such a process involves the only reasonable notion of transcendence available to humans, the ability to move beyond our current habits of thought and action to creatively remake some aspect of ourselves in our world. That is what we are engaged in the holidays, and in specific, but we're actually engaged in this every single day. But that is what we are actively engaged in. We are actively engaged in, as much as we are consciously doing so, remaking some aspect of ourselves and our world, even if it's our little world of experience that we're having right now. And that means then, somebody else noting the moral landscape from Sam Harris, also excellent. I actually consider Johnson and Harris's thing, they work quite well together. But that's what we're engaged in. We're engaged in this practice. And when we do so as deliberately as possible, we start seeing just how much flexibility we have in doing this. When we start noting what we're doing, we start recognizing, oh, the thoughts that I've had about, I never questioned this. This is what I've always done. This is the meaning that I've given to it. This is what shows up to me every single year around these stupid dates. I'm not even calling them holidays. They're just days that happen to be given an extra, social weight to them. So when we realize that, we can start going, well, now what? One practice that I have that I've done with some clients is to, and particularly getting out of, Christianity in particular, this also works for any, religion of damnation, is to actively think about hell and picture the worst part of it and then replace the flames with gumdrops and, silly putty.
Does
and
that one.
Cotton candy. I mean, like waving cotton candy all around and you're going, why? I mean, it's silly, but that's actually kind of the point, because the whole thing is silly. Yeah.
Turns out that hell is Big Rock Candy Mountain or something.
Oh my gosh. All the more reason to go there. Here it is. But that's just it's the practice of actively choosing to consider and rewriting these stories.
One of the statements I've just recently heard, which I really kind of like, is traditions is peer pressure by dead people.
Hmm. What? Yep. What do you mean?
Like, dead people are pressuring you to continue to do these traditions.
Are we talking about psychic mediums? I talked about this, Eric. Don't believe what the mediums tell you about the dead people.
Oh, we're talking about the traditions nice stuff. And starting to kind of make our own once I can kind of disconnect and say, hey, I don't have to do this, I'm not forced to do this, and on the flip side, I can start to make something that's meaningful to me, that seems very empowering. Feels empowering.
Yep, it absolutely is. I mean, it's one of the reasons, and I'm wearing this silly, stupid hat that, and it's, I don't know if anybody can do it, but it's like, I've been naughty. I mean, it's an active participation in what, growing up was a projection forward of Christmas into hell and damnation, because Christmas was really a pointer towards the inevitability of, the torturous substitution of us. And make Christmas great again. I love it. but it's having fun, poking at some of these things and learning to just laugh at the absurdity, because it is. The whole practice of this is absurd when we get down to the brass tacks of just what we're doing. I mean, and the joy around finding that absurdity is in noting, well, wait a minute, that means I can do whatever the fornication I want. it's like, I can do this. Like, here, what do I want to do? I mean, it's like, somebody mentions, crosses. Turn those suckers upside down and they're not crosses, they're swords, because you're waiting for the zombie apocalypse when we've used up all our bullets and we can't make any more, so we have to go. I know this was a plot line of a TV show, but It was an awesome TV show for as long as it lasted. And now I can't remember the name of it, but they had no more electricity and eventually they couldn't make any bullets. So everybody went back to sword fighting. It was awesome. So anyway, tangent.
I always have this fantasy of going up to somebody with a big crucifix on and saying, oh, I see you're a fan of the lowercase t.
Exactly. I mean, why not?
A new tradition could be Christmas tea.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, it's like the whole, you know, whether or not it's, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, you know, the three, you know, big baddies. And you've got, you know, this notion of, you know, initially paradise being, you know, hills of flowing milk and honey. And you're going, of course it was. They were in a desert. This does not exactly stretch the imaginative bounds for the meaning of their cosmic, you know, belief to be about something to avoid what they're having to face day in and day out, which is the utter destitution and despair of death all around them in the form of a desert. I mean, it's just like, you have to wonder, you know, people who, in fact, actually, we don't have to wonder. We know. We have stories of people who have, immigrated into, for instance, you know, the States and come from the so-called third world countries, and they get taken to a grocery store, and they're almost catatonic with choice overload. Because what do you mean you have 14 different brands of butter?
Just watched Moscow on the Hudson, an old Robin Williams film from 1984 or thereabouts. And yes, it was an exact scene like that. The first scene of Moscow on the Hudson is he's standing on a line that looks like it's hours long to get coffee. And then you fast forward, he's in New York. He goes into a supermarket. He asks, where's the coffee line? And coffee line, it's aisle 4. And he goes down and the whole aisle, and he's reading off the brand names of the coffee, and he's almost passes out because he can't believe it.
It is. It's utterly, it's astonishing. Just the degree to which, and again, speaking of behaviors that we just don't really think about. I mean, how often do we spend minutes pondering the Starbucks, menu, only to freaking order the same damn thing that we ordered the last 10 times? You know, it's like, it's this false notion that what we're doing in deliberating on these things as if it adds anything intrinsic, and it doesn't. It's just things that we are using to avoid having to deal with the fact that, well, a lot of the stuff is just silly. And if we just kind of all stood up and went, yeah, it kind of is, then who knows what could happen with it.
So that kind of goes to kind of the traditions and like the things that we do on holidays, but holidays are more than just traditions. Unfortunately, from my point of view, we have to interact with a lot of people. Yeah. There's family gatherings. I think friends gatherings are a little different because that might be more welcoming than possibly a family's gatherings. But so what do we, how would we kind of change our view or change our tradition, or how can I deal with my family when I show up and there's 70 people and it's just overwhelming?
Absolutely. So one of the things to kind of come forward from understanding that so many of these traditions, behaviors, and what we're doing is about organizing our resources for future situations is this idea of body budgeting. And so imagine for a moment that you're, you know, about to, you know, embark on, you know, a D&D quest. Let's go with the nerds. And, you know, and you're prepping. And it's like, okay, wait a minute. What do I need? like the DM's going, here's the general idea of the other villains and so on you're gonna have to deal with and so on. What do you want? But you can only fit this much in your pack. What do you want to do? And you're like, well, you know, I need this and I need that, and I need, you know, a certain spell book, and I need these number of potions, but I can't fit this many, so I need this. So if imagine the holidays, really anything, but since the theme here is holidays, imagine the holidays as that kind of quest. You have this, you know, field before you filled with, you know, possible, you know, socially created monsters and anxiety provoking situations. And you're going, okay, what do I need to mitigate? Like, I can't, you know, go off to a rock and meditate for the next 4 months because, you know, I have bills to pay. So I'm going to have to face, you know, these things to some degree. What can I do in order to, you know, mitigate the effect? So this is not a magic wand, because this is analogy, not real life. We can't, you know, get rid of all these things. We're going to have to work our way through it. So as a consequence, we're, you know, one way of looking at then is we are going to organize our resources. Two, we start being more aware of environmental influences. So the things that we take for granted, if you're working in real, you know, in any kind of, you know, sales job, guess what? You may have been doing this for a long time. You may not even realize just how pervasive, perhaps, you know, the holiday music happens to be. I mean, how many freaking renditions of Jingle Bells can we have? But we do it, and it fades in the background. But just because it fades in the background doesn't mean it's not affecting us. You know,
I hate it. I walk into a hardware store and it's playing. You know, and that's a part of it too. With Halloween, anxiety starts to creep up because I know Mariah Carey is defrosting and she's starting to warm up. Oh man. But yeah, you know, so I didn't even consider that.
Yeah.
I worked in a Baskin Robbins for 6 years in a mall. And of course, as soon as Thanksgiving, probably before Thanksgiving, they just started to play the music and it was so loud. I never played Christmas music when I went home.
Oh yeah, and so that's actually it's something I hadn't considered at all, David, is that not only is it just family gatherings, but it's also just kind of walking into public in general in a store.
Oh yeah.
I had not
seeing the wreath, seeing the lights. You know, it's like, and it doesn't matter, like the maybe not ha-ha funny, but funny and like, you know, Stephen King's It clown funny. You know, it's the amazing thing is that we don't actually know what the meaning is for any of the households that have any of these decorations up. We can assume, but we really don't. And statistically speaking, there are any number of families out there who have been putting up these lights and putting up any number of decorations, and they're not actually even believers. For all we know, we might be walking by an atheist house or a secular humanist house, and we don't even know it. But because the trappings of this have put on, you know, a certain meaning, and it's an automatic association, that we start getting, you know, this is where triggering comes in. It's like, oh shit, now what? And so, which is again, why stepping back at times and realize these don't have any intrinsic meanings, they're just objects, we give them to it, and maybe the other person doesn't. So being aware of environmental influences, coping strategies that you have already started using. Cannot emphasize this point enough, actually, is that do not shame yourself when the coping strategies that you've used before aren't working as well. The reason for this is that when it comes back to environment. Lately, I don't know if anybody is aware, but we've been in the midst of a pandemic, and there have been some social changes that have been happening. I swear this is like a geopolitical conversation around going through puberty. Like, hair is going to start growing in places that hasn't before. And I mean, it's really You almost have to have that conversation. But we have been. We've been in the midst of this colossal upheaval, and then combine that with political upheaval, and you're just going, what the hell? So all of the, thank you, Rob, for the mask. Yes. And, you know, and regardless of even where you may fall on all of this, the fact that it's so freaking confusing about everything. I mean, it's like my wife recently, you know, did a plane ride back and visited the family. And, you know, the instructions are you have to wear a mask the entire plane ride unless, but you can, you know, hold on to it and lift it up if you're going to eat or drink water. Yes, because the virus goes, oh, wait, you're drinking now. I'm going to pause in midair and not enter. I mean, there are so many of these things that are just asininely stupid, and we're engaging them for any number of reasons. We get back to, you know, behavior that has meaning that really doesn't have any real purpose anymore. And it, but it comes back to, again, social solidarity, comes back to knowing what you're going to expect moving forward. So many of these practices we've gotten into, and it's going to be actually, I'm sure there's going a little bit on a tangent here, but it's going to be a fascinating study to have for the next several years around the practices that continue that have been instituted over the last 18 months. And in fact, as a couple of therapists I follow who are have studied a lot of human sexuality have noted that there is some indication that certain sexual peccadilloes and like in proclivities towards certain kinks are based out of, you know, around that, like, you know, pubescent era, you know, time of development. And here you have an entire generation of the last couple of years now who have been wearing masks everywhere. And he just was, you know, speculating as the what the changes in various, for that matter, interests in porn down the road and so on that people are going to have. And just all of these different practices that are going to, you know, kind of seep into, you know, various things. Anyway, psych is fascinating, and that's a whole other thing. Yeah, mass sexual fetish, there's already a lot there. Yeah, I mean, if anybody wants to peruse, have some homework, peruse Pornhub.
I'll include some of those in the references, some links to porn, the mask fetish videos in Pornhub. You bet.
It's really trying to get demonetized here on YouTube, aren't
you? Jeez Louise. But so boy, now you're just gonna make the troll smashers work even harder with the next couple.
Sorry. Months.
But I love your analogy with the Dungeons and Dragons quest. At first, I'm thinking, "Oh my gosh, where is he going with?" But it makes perfect sense. Kind of like for me, when I kind of did this as a kid and growing up. When I would go to large family gatherings, I knew I had to bring a book and I had to bring a flashlight because number one, I would read in a corner. And then number two, I would want to read in the car in the dark on the way home. And so those were like, that was what kind of got me through and maybe a pair of swim trunks if there was a pool there. But now that you're talking about like going into stores or something, mm-hmm. I can totally see, like I could bring a pair of headphones with me and put on some of my own music and then kind of take them out when I want need to talk to someone. But I really like that. I like that concept of, okay, what do I, mm-hmm. what resources do I need to have? What do I need to prepare for?
Yep. And this is where we get into, we look ahead and we plan flexibly. You know, it's about, you know, taking one, just simply acknowledging that we cannot have 100% control over our environment, both internal and external. So therefore, stuff's gonna come up, difficulties are gonna arise, and we're gonna have to deal with them. This is Stoicism 101. I mean, this is what we're gonna have to work through, you know, stuff. So in fact, Eric, you're raising some great examples of what I'm about to mention. So we're going to go through four tactics to, you know, that can be flexibly applied and figure out how to address some of this stuff going on. One is maintaining diet and exercise. And by diet, I do not mean get on the next fad, get onto the latest TikTok crap and so on. Just for a second, I thought there couldn't be anything created that was worse than Twitter. TikTok nailed it. But anyway, I'm probably showing my age a little bit there. But anyway, yes, the internet always finds a way. Thank you for the comment. So maintain diet and exercise. And what I mean by that is as much as you want to indulge, it really isn't going to help the emotional living going forward. It really isn't. If you are, you know, your body, again, this is about body budgeting. This is about getting, you know, preparing for the things that are going to be coming next. And if your body's used to eating a particular way and having an exercise program that is at a certain level, when we start dropping those off, which is a common practice around the end of the year holidays, that is a huge contributor to all of the additional weight, emotional weight that is happening. Because not only do we have to deal with the things that we can't not deal with, but then we're reducing the resources that we've been building up to deal with these things. Which is of course part of the difficulty is because so many of the social practices around these holidays is to do the very things that undermine our ability to deal with. You know, somebody mentioned, you know, in comments around, you know, childhood indoctrination. Really, at the end of the day, it can be helpful to look at every single cultural practice as indoctrination of some level. Literally, single thing we do is some layer of indoctrination. It's just trying to indoctrinate us in one direction or another. And it depends, the only variation is the kind of the negative or the punishment that gets put on non-acquiescence, really. I mean, it's really all it is variations in, you can kind of not do this and it's not gonna be a big deal. In one circle, but if you don't do it in another circle, whew, complete ostracism. If you do this in a different one, great, now you've got tons of support and so on. I mean, it's really, you know, it's a bit melodramatic, I'm getting that, but it can be helpful to start looking at all of these things of what we're doing as essentially a way of, you know, controlling and thinking, putting ourselves in a particular mindset, in a particular way of viewing things. And that's it. I mean, this is, for that matter, this is, mimetics, 101, for anybody who's, you know, studied that. It's really,
kind of going back to the beginning, it sounds like mm-hmm. these things are, this indoctrination is making things predictable. Okay.
Ultimately, that's its purpose. It just depends on what it's wanting
the result us to you're looking for. Yeah.
Is the ideology and the group that has these practices, you know, built up. You know, it's you walk into, you know, like, why do you not fart in a funeral? because it's not, you know, or belching. What? Some cultures to belch after a meal is considered, hey, that's awesome. It showed that this was an amazing meal. And others, oh my gosh, how freaking rude can you be? You know, to even talk about, you know, sex at all in some cultures is totally fine. In others, anathema. And of course, historical, you'll have changes in that. I mean, we've gone from table legs being considered a, you know, almost fetish, to, you know, now you can go into basic cable and, you know, I've gotten caught up on, don't judge, Riverdale, the TV show. And you literally have these 20-something-year-old actors portraying themselves as teenagers, engaging in any amount of sexual activity. And you're going, well, wait a minute. If they were actually, we'd all be going to jail watching this show. But it's selling a fiction. And what is that? I don't know. But, you know, any number, you know, there's any number of issues around all of this. But the reality is we've gone from, you know, only a couple hundred years ago of, you know, these various, you know, furniture issues being, you know, too much of a problem to now this is just so common. And what are we doing about it? How does this work? This isn't a whole like anti-sex thing, but it's just, you know, we have variations in this.
Going back to the getting prepped for these events, mm-hmm. Kind of hit me, like, not only should we prepare with our physical things, like, for example, me, a book and a flashlight, but also the conversational, the interactions, or even maybe the emotional stuff that we might experience. Like, okay, so Uncle Roy is going to come up to me and say, ah, that Biden guy, huh? He's doing a horrible job. And so, you know, those kinds of things, I would also need to prepare myself. Like, how am I going to respond to that? What would I feel comfortable? Do I want to engage with him? Is there something I can say that can maybe deflect it? And then just realizing, okay, I'm going to get overwhelmed. And I'm going to just know that going into it. So it's more than just the physical things. Yes. I can stuff my backpack with topics of conversation maybe, or ways to divert questions I don't want to answer, or topics, yep, I don't want to discuss.
How about that government trying to make everybody get those Bill Gates microchip fluids into their body?
I know they're gonna be praying at the table, and that's not something I want to do or participate. How am I going to handle this?
So here we go. So we'll go to third and back to two. So find the shared meaning. Even, you know, I've already mentioned this a bit before, but even the most religious person is still human. And therefore, they're interested in connecting social practices to consistency. So if we look at the prayer activity as just an activity that we give, that each and every single person around that table is giving meaning to it, that there is nothing intrinsic to the idea of, you know, doing this, or crossing self, or, you know, thank goodness Jesus wasn't hung, because then he'd have to do like this. I mean, it's really...
I don't know if he was hung. I haven't... the paintings look like he was.
Well, very well, so it seems. But, you know, the idea of being here...
Rob just got it.
I was like, wait...
Oh, that's on the line that you were going to edit out that you said before.
Rob's old face. So we have, but you know, once we were able to step in and go, great, wait a minute, this is literally just people putting themselves in a certain physiological state in order to, in mouthing words, do I have to, or can I pause for a moment and go, this is just another practice to find solidarity with the people around them and find some kind of consistency in their life, even if it's only in this few, you know, these next few moments. That's all this is. And this doesn't remove, I want to be careful here, this does not remove any trauma that people have gone through. It does not remove the negativity of how certain practices have been applied and so on. Does not remove any of that. What it does is provide a at least initial blueprint to being able to move on from and no longer seeing. I'm gonna have to, you know, look at some of these links later. Is moving on from idea. Yes, do not click on them on a work computer. Don't do it. is to move on from the idea that these we have to accept and hold on to the meaning that we have been given about these things. We don't. There's absolutely no necessity for us to continue agreeing or acquiescing to the meaning that we were given around basic just bodily actions. There is no necessity to this. We have the capacity to be able to say, guess what? That was fornicated up and I'm going to, you know, do something else about this. And yes, and I realize it's more complicated than that and it takes practice, but the reality still is that when we can start separating the behavior from the meaning, we can start inserting our own, and in fact, even finding some commonality, even with the family members that we otherwise would like to have nothing to do with, and we're kind of stuck with for the next few hours until we can, you know, find a book to read in a corner to read it in. So
can you say that again? If we can remove the action from the meaning, you said it really well. Say it.
If we can separate the behavior from the meaning. You know, in the way that in the structure that I use for therapy, it's separating the behavior from the story or the narrative. We do, behavior does not automatically, or rather, let me rephrase that, does not necessitate any particular story about it. Stories are automatic, is why I had to rephrase. They will come automatically, but there's no necessity for one story to be it. Like, and we know this from even since, you know, sex keeps coming up, you know, it's, we know this from our own, you know, evolution away from looking at sexuality as an awful thing that can only be made pure inside of holy matrimony. The reality is that we can reshape, and the behaviors themselves do not have to have that story. We can put something else there. We can make something, frankly, far more beautiful out of this because we have that capacity because we're human. Yay, go us. We can do this.
It almost sounds like you're hijacking the us humans, meaning-making machines. As meaning-making machines, you're hijacking that and putting it back into our own control.
Yep. We can't, I mean, really... a little long, you know, but mental health and making and helping facilitate our better, not perfect, but better life really is about learning the processes that we cannot change about how our human mind works and reusing them in ways that are better. We are not going to stop the capacity for us to make meaning. It's just not going to happen any more than we are going to stop our capacity for bias, because it is hardwired to think certain things in a simplistic way. What we can do is become aware of these processes and help mitigate how we, you know, use these things. Same thing, for instance, with body budgeting. We're not getting rid of this process. It is not going to go away. It is baseline physiological. This is how things work. And so we're not going to be able to transcend how our bodies work with things. So instead, let's use the hell out of it in a way that makes more sense, that helps us live better lives and gets us away from the utter bunk that far too many of us, one, grew up with and are still surrounded by. So let's, you know, have fun with it.
I like that, because my initial reaction might be, oh, this mechanism isn't working for me, so I need to get rid of it. But that's obviously impossible to do. So instead, you're kind of saying, this mechanism, if it's not working for you, find a way to make it work for you. Mm-hmm. That's freeing. That feels like I'm no longer locked into my past behavior. Like I have this control over it.
Yep. And in fact, we do this with our bodies quite often. I mean, all of the science behind macros, you know, really what happens, for instance,
macros?
Macros. It's a nutritional thing. Where
macronutrients. Okay.
Yes. And for instance, you know, hell, for that matter, diabetes. I mean, effectively, what we're doing with diabetes is, through medical technology and changes in behavior.
Okay.
There we go. So what we're doing with medical technology when it comes to diabetes is using the body's own systems to do and create something different. That's really what we're doing. We're hijacking this process and going, we can do something different with this. And so much of, and all we're doing is just expanding that to, you know, the mind, you know, the mind body, you know, issue. Okay. It's really what we're doing. And so part of that then is, so we're finding the shared meaning. We're reducing struggles. So we know things are coming. And so we're going to maintain the things that are already working for us. And then we're going to reduce struggles. If we know that there are mountains coming in our journey, why are we going to go, you know what, that path over there, that's totally how it would usually go, but it's like this steep, but there's one over here that's this steep. I'm going to avoid that because I've always done this one. Why? You know, why bother? So this means, in fact, hey, guess what? Maybe step back from social media.
Mm.
You know, this isn't a whole like social media is evil, although much of it is. You know, it's not even that, you know, it's some big thing about it's hijacking our dopamine systems, because it's not quite how that's working. But it is about when we take stock of, it could be social media, it could be any number of things. Take stock of the things that you typically are finding yourself being emotionally drained or incensed by, and dial it down a couple notches for the next 3 months. Just dial it down. Like, you know, if you're on, you know, you're doom scrolling through Facebook and, you know, 3 hours a day, maybe reduce it to two. And, you know, it's about understanding that we have limited resources and environment is changing during this time of holidays. So therefore, let's reduce the activities that are draining us that in a different situation, we could totally handle. We were fine. Like, whatever, give me the Facebook, just, you know, inject it. But now in this process, it's, you know, the threshold has been lowered because of the changes in the social environment, which means we need to take stock of that and reduce some of the things we're doing. Take time off if possible. You know, if you have that capacity, do so. You've been saving it up all year because guess what? You probably didn't go on vacation at all because who was going anywhere? But now use it. Even if it's only, you know, still being around, you know, local, at least you're no longer inundated by just the mentality of, oh, right, I have work to go. You know, focus on solid friendships, you know, the ones that are continuing and been supportive, instead of figuring out, well, gee, how many new connections can I make over the next 2 months in a dozen parties? It's maybe I go to only six parties, and on my off time, I'm really doubling down on, you know, the connections that have been tried and true and supportive. Because again, the environment that we're in has reduced the thresholds for what we're able to cope with, which means that we need to take stock of what else we're doing. And the old behaviors that used to be fine are now, you know, going to cause some problems, and coping techniques that we used to use that were fine are no longer meeting the needs that we have in this time. This is a time crunch. When we get into, you know, January, February, and, you know, it's fine.
I love that, because to me, I'm envisioning like the computer that I'm working on has limited resources. So open up the task manager, close the stuff you're not using to, because you're about to launch a big game that's going to suck up all the resources. And so I love that. I never, ever considered that. So like, reduce your time on social media or get out into, if you like going on hiking or trails or walking or animals, get out and get more of that. I love that. I had never thought about that. That's pretty darn cool.
Take up a new creative enterprise, new creative behavior. Like it can be silly. Take up finger painting, whatever. It doesn't matter. it's one of the reasons I recently got back into photography. And a lot of it is about expressing yourself differently, seeing the world in a different way, so that you can access the flexibility of recognizing I don't have to see things the way that I thought I needed to. Every single idea in cultural practice is some form of indoctrination. When we start, kind of looking at that things that way, we start going, wait, even asking the question, even the most trivial of things we look at is like, do I want to be indoctrinated by that? I mean, yes, it's silly, but hey, it makes it that much more, it brings to a greater awareness just what's going on. And even if we can ask this question of everything, because we have limited time, we can at least ask it a few times to go, wait, what are the things that I'm doing? What are the stories that I'm telling that I don't actually need to perpetuate? These are just things that I was told. That's it. Okay.
Now these kinds of tactics, they're not like a flip of a switch at all. This sounds like it's gonna take practice. And it also sounds like when I show up, I'm gonna screw up somehow. I'm not gonna nail it on the first time. And so
no.
I'm kind of asking a leading question. Should I give myself some grace if I do get messed up, but then just recognize it for next time?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And this is where it comes back to don't shaming yourself about how, coping strategies you've used before are no longer working as well. It has nothing to do with there being anything broken or, bad or even diagnosable about you. I mean, this is, I get this a lot with clients going, I've just been feeling overwhelmed recently. What did I catch? You didn't catch anything. Like this is, you didn't suddenly, like, depression isn't floating around for you to like ingest it or inhale it. It's like asking the question of somebody who, is standing in front of their house that just burned down and all their possessions are gone and their family dog perished. And they're going, how do you feel? Well, I feel pretty darn upset and depressed right now. Oh, well now, that must be, some kind of issue going on. No, it's not. It's just that you're reacting to a really shitty environment. And a lot of what's going on is we are reacting to environments that are not conducive to, working through things as in the way that we used to. And couple that with this notion that any moment of feeling down or adversity or whatever must mean that there's something wrong with us. And suddenly we're trying to pathologize every single negative feeling that we have. It's just a reaction to everyday crap. And if we can step back from and go, I don't need to, and yes, it does take practice. And sometimes we will get sucked into it. Sometimes we will still, one of my go-to practices when I'm feeling depressed, even with I know 100% that this is not going to help me out, is to go get a bag of snake gummies and I will chow down that entire freaking bag. I don't care. I will just do it because I will have that momentary fix of feeling better, even though I know it's BS and I'm going to feel bad later when I have a stomach cramp. I mean, it's just, I know this. And so I've been knowing this for years. So we still do this. But again, when we find ourselves doing that, we non-shamefully go, all right, hit the gummies again. And now what am I going to do next? I mean, it's just,
give me the gummies.
Give me the gummies.
Those are delicious, though.
They are. I mean, seriously. Yeah, they really. Now I'm going to have to go get some. But, you know, when we find ourselves falling down, I mean, it really is the cliche of like, and you have to get yourself back up. But there's some truth to it because, you know, the reality is that we're in CBD gummies. Ooh, there we are. funny story. Anyway, I'm going to go on that tangent. But, you know, it's when we figure out that even the story that we have about, in fact, the we shouldn't have done this, that itself is a story. We don't actually have to perpetuate it. We can look at it and go, oh, well, thanks for showing up again. I'm going to move on to the next one and see if the next time around, because it will be a next time, that I can take the knowledge that I've gained. I can acknowledge as well that I am a different person by itself necessity because I have the past as it continually collapses into our imagined future. And so who we are is constantly changing and growing. We can take what has come before and go, what do I want to do next? And maybe just shift the possibility even a tad will open us up to a number of different ways of reacting and being. And even if it's dealing with family.
That sounds hopeful. Sounds also empowering too.
Yeah.
So to summarize, it's kind of like, all right, so prepare for what's going to happen. Like think about it beforehand, prepare for what's going to happen. Work on maybe limiting what's going on to conserve your resources. And then you can make your own meaning mm-hmm. out of what you're experiencing and how you're seeing things, whether it's a new tradition or an old tradition. Is that about to sum it up?
Pretty much. Yeah. It really is just exactly that. I mean, we are, you know, taking a look at breaking it out even further. It's maintain the things that help, reduce the things that don't, and look for the shared meaning in everything.
I'll be perfectly.
If you really
honest,
want to tack on a fourth one, recognize that you're the one choosing what the meaning is going to be anyway. So have fun with it.
As I began to kind of pull away from my extended family and there would be fewer and fewer and fewer people at these holiday gatherings, I started to enjoy the holidays more and more. Like, and when I started to kind of become independent and be able to drive around by myself and celebrate with some friends, that became more and more enjoyable too. I love the part of what you said, reducing the stuff you don't like and increase the stuff that you do like. That's,
yeah.
I could see that. That's kind of how I naturally did it. And I got some great results out of it. That's cool.
I've honestly found myself, I mean, there was a couple of weeks ago, I ended up, I've also started doing some very non-professional DJing and, you know, I was asked to do basically holiday music for this, you know, lighting. They were, you know, putting lights on in this local park. And a lot of the, you know, so-called Christmas songs are, I mean, when you really kind of look at it and some of the historical, you know, fundamentalist meaning, Not a big fan. Quite disturbing. And yet there is, over the years, even with some of those, finding out that in finding my own meaning in some of these, and just, even if it's not the meaning in the words themselves, because some of it's quite atrocious, is remembering that feel of solidarity, that feel of connection, that feel of the tears that inevitably flowed during the holiday services. And yes, I can totally jettison the fear and damnation and that kind of bullshit, but I can still appreciate that the laughter and the hugs and the just sheer joy of being around other people in a shared, a community is just, at that level, is a beautiful thing. Even if I unequivocally condemn, some of the ideas behind it, it's still, I don't have to throw everything out and can still appreciate the fact that, the veneer that is being thrown on human experience can be awful, but the human experience doesn't have to be.
Perfect. David, thank you so much. I mean, I came into this kind of anxious, but a little hopeful, because I struggle. It's dark for me during these holidays, but you've given me some tools and kind of a ray of light that I can use and make these holidays better and better every single year as I'm getting more and more used to working this way. Well, thank you for that. I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, we have got we got a question. And if you've got some questions, folks, type them in the chat, both here and over at Atheist Community Discord. Rob, you want to take the first question?
Yes, thank you, Eric. So the person asked, and this is sort of personal because a lot of my family is religious and I've been in this circumstance and never know quite what to do. So they asked, is it okay to excuse yourself from meals when people are about to pray?
That is going to be a case by case basis. And I'm not trying to do a cop out answer. It really, it's going to be really how. So instead of answering that particular scenario, instead we can apply some of the points that we were just discussing. So if that's a behavior that you are thinking about doing, so essentially you've looked at the situation, you go, you know what? The only way that I think that I can deal with this is just by excusing myself. Like I have to remove myself from it. And that's what I'm going to do. Okay, your decision. Plan ahead. Don't make that. And, when everybody's about to do this, go like, so peace out. likely not going to be all that helpful. Instead, bring it up ahead of time and just go, look, I appreciate the fact that you all, want to do this, but it's not something that has the meaning that you have in it. I feel uncomfortable and I just like to step out. And maybe instead of even stepping out, it's maybe a change can be made where the prayer happens and you actually step in afterwards. So hell, for that matter, you can even see the prayer as a declaration for your entrance. So, again, and this comes back to the story making. Look at it. Oh, they're bowing their heads because I'm about to enter the room.
Amen, indeed. Here I am. What a great introduction, folks. You're probably wondering why I called you here tonight.
And I have some new commandments for you, by the way.
Exactly. Boy, have a deal for you. If you get five people to sell this widget, you're gonna make a ton of money. That's awesome.
Granted, you don't have to say that story out loud.
One of the things I like to do is I just like to keep my eyes open and look around the room. And it's kind of interesting to see who else has the
mic. Oh, yes, that is wonderful. And they're looking like, this is stupid. Oh, thank you. I'm going to talk to you later.
Yeah. David, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Yeah. Before we kind of wrap up and conclude, firstly, we have a hangout. Do you have some time to kind of hang out with us afterwards?
Yeah.
Great. Before we conclude, do you have any final thoughts, any things that you wanted to say that you didn't say during the discussion?
Really, cannot emphasize enough that what we're doing all the time is our own meaning-making process. Mm. Like it's there. The idea of creating narratives is overdone. So I'm going to get on that kind of bandwagon. But the reality, this thing is that it is what we're doing. We're all in this trying to not even make sense of things, but apply a structure that we then declare makes sense. And when we just simply step back and recognize that all of us are in the same boat of making stuff up as we go along, it really can be a source of just laughing a lot more. Because pretty much 99% of what we do in life is really kind of ridiculous. And we might as well just, have fun with it. None of us are getting out of this alive. So
let's have some fun.
Mary. Yeah. In fact, was it? I remember there was a Christmas claymation video when I was a kid. And claymation, man, talk about artistic genius to do with that stuff. But there was this thing about where there was a talking horse or something, and they came across, he ended up getting completely drunk by the end of this. It was a children's thing, but anyway, but he was completely, in fact, I think it was a donkey. So the fact that he was drunk off his ass was probably an adult level of humor that the kids completely didn't get. But it was basically like blessing wine. And it was just like, yeah, I went around and I'm celebrating this and I'm celebrating this. So let's, or it was wassail. It was this word that he was giving. Let's wassail our way to, basically getting drunk. And it was just, this is absurd. So I'm not advocating getting drunk. I'm just saying, have some fun with it. Yeah.
David, thank you so much.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.